This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I am so excited for today because we've got Nick Palella on the program. He is VP of Development at Marcon. Everybody that listens to this program probably knows who Marcon is. Household name, big developer in the city, building really, really beautiful buildings throughout the Lower Mainland. So we're super excited to have Nick on the show, and it's been long overdue.
For a very long time, we've had multiple people say, you got to get Nick on the show. And finally, we got him on. Marcon's a family business. The origin story is incredible.
Right. Better than our family business origin story.
I would say. But one thing about this conversation is we weave an in and out of basically any topic I feel like we've ever kind of covered, and we run long, but any topic we've ever really covered on the podcast, we throw at Nick, and every one of his answers, I feel like, man, I want to drill down and have him back and just isolate these topics and spend an hour on each.
Well, yeah, we talk about the development community, politics of building, scaling a business, opportunities in the market.
Dealing with zoning.
Why timing is maybe not everything when it comes to real estate. And my favorite thing about this conversation is Nick seems to kind of challenge a lot of the conventional wisdom around real estate, just in general, right? Whether it's industry practices, or it's investing ideas or concepts. It's just a lot comes out of this where you're like, oh yeah, that's not the standard way. That's not the status quo, but it makes a lot of sense what you're saying.
Exactly. Nick's a younger guy.
Right.
And Marcon's actually a younger company than I think a lot of people would assume.
Right.
Considering
where they are,
how high the concrete towers are they're building right now and how successful the brand is. But one thing I would say is second generation, and he's clearly got a vision of where he's taking Marcon, and it's really kind of incredible.
It is incredible. Before we get to our conversation with Nick, Matt, I should say a couple things. One is we just had the mayor of Nanaimo on Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast. That was launched earlier this week. So if you haven't listened to our sister show, Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast, or VCREP with Corey Wright, go check that one out. It's a great conversation about the future of Nanaimo.
Corey is actually going after every bigwig politician on the island, it seems like. It's kind of incredible. Every week I hear about who the guest is. It's like, next up's JT.
Yeah, well, he's looking for a career in politics, clearly, with not only the way he dresses, but the amount of politicians he's trying to get on the program. So yeah, no, it's a good episode, though. If you are interested at all in Vancouver Island, just in general, there's some fantastic content going on VCREP. So check out that. And then the other thing I'll mention is that we had a lot of people reach out about the Clint Murphy episode about, basically it's about fire and real estate investing and fire fat, right?
Right.
Lots of people reaching out about how to retire through real estate investing. Clint did a great job of unpacking those ideas. So if you haven't listened to that episode, it's two back. Go check it out. It's a popular one.
Last but not least, Adam, we've been putting our Instagram handle on the show, and it's been growing, you know, decently, I would say.
Yeah.
A recent sale that you were involved in, a renovation project. We've had a lot of people reach out wanting to know the details. That is forthcoming. We're going to sit down and I'm going to interview you about that project, what it looks like, what the challenges were, how partnerships work, what the deals look like, all the rest. So stay tuned for that.
Fantastic. Well, Matt, this is a long one today, and it's a great episode. So many takeaways. Nick Palella, enjoy. This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects, Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more. And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one beds to three beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Okay, so we're here with Nick Paolella. He is currently the VP of development at Marcon. How you doing, Nick?
Good, thanks.
Down in the studio, this is great to have you in, Nick. Thanks so much for coming down. Can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm born and raised in the Lower Mainland. I grew up in Langley. I've been in our family business since I was crawling, and grew up out in the valley. Ended up going out to university out at UBC, and continued to kind of work while I was going to university wherever I could find an opportunity to try to learn both sides of the world while I was growing up, in the practical sense and in the academic sense. And getting through that kind of gave me the opportunity to hit the ground running. And, you know, for the last, you know, decade, I've been full tilt in our business and having a lot of fun.
So it's funny because before we went live here, we were talking about your grandfather actually grew up on the West Side. So Langley was a bit of a departure for your family.
Yeah. So my dad and his family moved out from Vancouver into Langley in the 70s into the rural area. And my dad actually got his start into construction, working on farms, building barns and helping with like agricultural construction.
Wow. So Carisdale to like rural Langley is a unique move, I guess, in the early 70s. Was there a farming kind of component
my grandfather was a hairdresser. And that was also, it's always a confusion. It's like, great, the old man must have come from Italy and started a
growing grapes
company
or something.
And then, then he built this construction company and the next generation took it in the next one. It's not that at all. No, my grandfather was a hairdresser, super successful, decided to move out to the valley. And my dad started, you know, in his early teenage years, started working on farms and started kind of learning the basic rope of construction through that. And he actually thought he was going to be a welder getting out of high school because there was lots of money to be made welding pipeline in Alaska. And while he was waiting on the BCIT list to get into the program, which at the time was a couple years, because any blue collar guy who wanted the opportunity to get into like a trade that was at the time quite successful was going to that field. So he was stuck waiting. And over that time, he kind of continued to jump into construction work and framing houses, building barns, jumping on different crews. And then, you know, even within a couple short years, he started to realize that was going to be more the gig for him. And so the valley became the growing grounds for Marcon ultimately. It was good timing because you were talking about the 80s and urban development was just taking root out in the valley at that time. So lots of the traditionally Vancouver developers who were now going further east, I kind of liken it to like folks going to Squamish these days in a way. It was kind of like a new frontier for urban growth for the right reasons. They were coming out there and actually the building community really hadn't established itself south of the Fraser at that point too much. You still had a lot of the trades labor force still living in the Coquitlam, Burnaby, East Vancouver area. Of course, we know the dynamics of affordability have shifted that in a major way now. But it meant that developers were coming out to the valley and looking for building support out there. And so that, you know, my dad in his early 20s took that opportunity to sit in city council meetings and tap developers on the shoulder and say he was the local guy and he could help them out.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. And it, yeah, that's funny because I was thinking Marcon had kind of a potentially a deeper lineage, but it's
no,
it's
no, no. My dad founded things 37 years ago now. And I think Marcon was not even much of an intention. I think it started by spray painting a sign on the side of a site trailer. And I think it was originally Mark Construction and it needed to fit on a sign. So he spray painted Marcon with yellow and black and the rest is history.
That's fantastic. Like one of the things I think about is, you know, you said that you basically since you were crawling, you've been immersed in kind of the company. And it's interesting because a lot of people that are brought up in a family business, you go one of two ways, right? You kind of either embrace the business or you resist it. Or at least that's what seems to be a common trajectory for people. Why real estate?
You know, that one is one I've thought about that a lot. I think it is a big thing that people trip up on in the advent of family business, where sometimes people in kind of new, you know, younger generations are kind of forced with the dilemma of trying to fit themselves into a career path that is kind of destined for them, that doesn't work for them, but they do it because of some driver of, you know, appeasing the family, perhaps lifestyle considerations, what have you. And that can be really difficult, right? And I think I've had the great fortune, I think my brothers as well, I have two brothers. I think we've all had the fortune of finding our path into the second generation of our business really organically. And yeah, we just had the benefit of an upbringing where kind of learning about, you know, initially construction and then into the real estate side of things was very fluid, you know. It was part of our life. We grew up on a big farm. We were constantly building things on the farm and work was just part of our life in that regard. So there was no fear of getting things done and learning how these steps in construction go. And then it was just exposure to it, where we had constant opportunity to see what my dad had going on at the time. And it was a very tight-knit group of people for many years who were helping to build the company that we had great personal relationships with. A lot of these folks who are similar to my dad's age raised families alongside ours. And so we just had some great, you know, great relationships and kind of an era where it was never forced. It was just something that we were just immersed in and that we all got to embrace in a different way. And, you know, I had a particularly kind of keen curiosity for how the business itself worked. And, you know, as I grew up, came to learn beyond the construction was the real estate development activity we had and what that entailed. And so I got the opportunity actually pretty early on to start learning that. Well, I was probably still in like early high school. I started learning the ropes from a couple of guys who were with us in the formative years of our development capacity, which was probably a decade preceding when we started construction. And so I kind of started running the gauntlet of performas and numbers and the basic fundamentals of the market and all of those things when I was probably like 13, 14. So it was a great leg up, but it all just was fluid. It was, if we had days off, we were working, it was working on a site or it was learning in the office. It was just embracing it and it felt right. It just never felt like, you know, for me personally, like I was on a path that was anything other than what I absolutely loved and was engaged with. So I guess I was fortunate that way.
One thing that strikes me, and we've talked to other companies that have scaled quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So we're talking Marcon here from kind of the 80s, like tapping people on the shoulder. Hey, we can help out in the valley to kind of, you know, I think Clark and Como, there's all these concrete high rises now that Marcon's doing that everybody knows about. I'm just curious, growing up, like that level, that pace of growth, kind of what it was like family life. Like,
actually, it was wonderful. Like I thought we got a great, like we had great access to my parents, both my parents and their engagement in our upbringing, despite the fact that the business was growing. I think that was really founded on growth that was generated as a result of the great relationships my dad had established with a number of developers in the region who basically, you know, the outcome was as they grew, we grew. And we of course took on new opportunities and for many years now, we've been kind of, you know, passing on more opportunities than we take on, because, you know, scalability is a really important thing to be mindful of, or you can burn yourself. And so our kind of, you know, the growth of the company over the years, it was incremental. Quick, I guess, when you think of it in hindsight, every 2-3 years, you're doing something more than you thought you were going to be doing.
Right.
I think that, I was talking about that with my dad not long ago. I said, you know, it feels like as long as I've been around, every 2-3 years, the complexion of things have been kind of immensely more than we were planning. Not that is not a bad thing, not that we're not handling it. It's just that we don't have kind of a maniacal growth plan to be more, do more than anybody, or kind of set some arbitrary benchmark. We just want to do good work, build good quality homes and workplaces for folks. And then, you know, the opportunity to spur themselves on if you've got good people, et cetera. So I think, you know, you go way back, you know, you go near the beginning. It was really firstly like foundational on the relationships that were established, which we were doing right by. People trusted us to deliver on their needs at the time in construction. That led into real estate development partnerships. And then it led into regional growth. We followed people where they went in the region. We found investment in those places as well. And then the scale kept growing. I mean, regionally, the scale of development's been growing for years, right? I mean, you see that when we started doing towers and building towers in the early 2000s, like your typical tower was like 18 to 30 stories.
Sure, right.
And now they're, you know, 40 to 60 regularly. And
right.
So, you know, the scale is as much kind of, you know, it's partly intentional, partly opportunistic, and it's partly that the industry is that it's just the built form in the built environment's changing. And so scale is coming with it. I think, you know, as we grew through that, we were watching all these accomplishments. And I remember, you know, just, we were fascinated by some of these projects, which were kind of, you know, became signature kind of milestones in our growth. It was a new scale of kind of multifamily. We were kind of one of the early riders. We were one of the early builders in six-story wood when that came around. When we got into towers, we actually developed a tower ourselves so that others knew we could do a tower, and it became very fluid. We weren't waiting to prove it. We just did it ourselves, and then people had that confidence in us. So we had those milestones. We built some really interesting commercial real estate and developed it over the years that flagged other kind of milestones for us. So I guess, you know, I definitely followed it pretty closely as a kid. And like, sometimes people joke when I kind of recall the past and the issues of the past, et cetera. And they go, you weren't even around then. You weren't even working then. Like, how are you even pulling these off the top of your head? I said, well, I listened. I was around enough to hear where the issues were and what
I was
happened.
In the backseat of the car.
Exactly, right? So it was like, and I didn't have headphones in, or I wasn't plugged into an iPad or something. So I don't know. You just kind of absorb it. You sponge it in, right? And that history has actually paid a lot of dividends out. And just, you know, you think being early on in your career, you know, you can make lots of mistakes and you can learn a lot. And I think having the context and a bit of the experience kind of helps buffer some of your problem solving, you know, as you live it day to day.
You know, one thing that I was curious in asking, you kind of spoke to it, but the development industry in Vancouver seems like, you know, very high stakes and hyper competitive, right? And it seems like, you know, that trajectory, I guess I'm wondering if you had to isolate kind of a few kind of things that Marcon has done right to kind of to grow into what it is, kind of a household name, what those have been.
Well, it's interesting. Maybe later we can talk about what high stakes and competitiveness, because I have a slightly different perspective on that. But maybe that's because I haven't been exposed to anything different just living in this industry to date. But like at the end of the day, I think any business, any industry has to be focused on the customer. And, you know, speaking for real estate development, let's set aside our construction business for a second, or clients, the person we're building with, and still the customer, which is part of what's kind of been a huge thing for our measurement of quality, is like we care about that. And even if we're building it for someone else versus developing it, we care about that consumer as much because it's our brand that covers all of these projects, right? But I think it's firstly looking at like really the kind of the foundational legacy our buildings leave from a quality perspective, from a timelessness perspective. There's such a series of choices you make through a development and construction process that I think people take for granted, which is kind of like, you could call it the high road, the low road, you know, the value engineering decision. You go down a rabbit hole on a small issue just to make sure you made the right decision, or do you say it doesn't matter and you move forward? I think, you know, foundationally, our strength has come out of building good product with a focus on delivering something that the homeowner, the initial homeowner, will be proud of, and subsequent end users down the line are going to be satisfied with, and ultimately, you know, get everything they need out of a home to enjoy their lives. And so if we lose sight of that, I think we lose the war as a whole. You could put all kinds of lipstick on the real estate development kind of activities out there. You could be ingenious with rezonings. You could be sharp on your front end with, you know, marketing sales endeavors. But I think it's really the fundamental piece of making the right design choices that influence people's outcomes and ultimately delivering a quality product that to us is like, there's a resiliency to that. That's the thing that if things weren't as buoyant in the market, people would be probably looking closer at, in my view. And we'd rather build for the day when someone stops and wants to look at a detail, understand why we've done something, and they want to not have that headache after they've lived in a building, you know, 5-10 years down the road. Even if people don't care about it when they're on a fast floor selling units in a hot market, that's not really what we're about. And so I think that's an anchoring position for us that we try to keep in light of all the other pieces that have made, you know, contemporary development. And it is quite a sophisticated industry. So there's lots of different layers that you have to consider when you're putting these projects together.
And just to circle back here, different perspective on high stakes and competitive. I'm kind of curious
thinking about that as well. And it seems like, you know, it almost ties in with like the maniacal plan, because I think a lot of people think developers are kind of selfishly moving through the market, trying to win in a competitive marketplace. But if you visit UDI, you realize that, you know, it's a pretty welcoming, collaborative community in many cases as well.
And I think we're all lemmings. Someone sticks their head out, you know, their neck out there half an inch, you know, they do something different a little bit. And then all of a sudden it becomes the talk of the town, and everybody in, you know, 6 months has adopted the same practice. You know,
right.
it's a funny one. And yeah, I mean, I'd say the reason I feel like competition is a funny one in our industry here is Vancouver, proportionately to its scale, has a lot of growth for good reason with population growth that we have to deal with as a region, you know, year over year. And that reality being seemingly the case for decades ahead. You know, without that, you know, I think the pool of developers and just the general, all the supporting pieces of this industry would not be nearly as robust as they are. Vancouver, I think, is a funny ecosystem where the land market is very tight. There's sophistication in terms of underwriting and understanding municipal context and, you know, a lot of different details that actually makes it there's a lot of barriers of entry for others to jump in who are kind of do conventional real estate in other places, and not vice versa. There's often Vancouver developers who go to other places and do quite well because there's a tightness in that. But in the literal sense of competition, I don't really feel it. I find that, and this has been something that we've been attempting to think through and move the needle on. I'm not going to profess that we've got it mastered or that we're even close to kind of getting to the end of our journey on this. But it occurs to me that there's been practices in this industry for 20, 30 years, like kind of since like circa 1990s, in terms of the way our customer-facing process goes, that have really just been augmented by like small pivots. And those small pivots just get echoed by almost everybody and becomes common practice very quickly after a little bit of risk is taken. I don't know if the way we've done things for 20 to 30 years is actually matching the way a contemporary consumer wants to purchase their goods and make their decisions, their buying decisions. If you compare that to like many different industries and how we're reaching out to customers, how people have the opportunity to absorb information, how they can learn and get content without committing themselves to interactions with, you know, salespeople or people trying to push them down the funnel. And then ultimately, sure, I mean, home buying is a major decision for folks, and either as an end user or an investor. So it requires a greater level of service. But I think there's a bunch of touch points along the way as we deliver that service, from someone learning about a project to getting through the sales process and ultimately to delivery of a home and hopefully good customer service, is that I think we have a rhythm in this industry that we think we've got down pat, but I think it's mostly complacency. We've got it. And I think it's complacency because things have been selling pretty well for about 30 years. Like, it's not really ever stopped. And so I don't know how often there's pause to kind of muse about what could be different. And so that's we're starting that. We don't have it figured out. We want to make moves that hopefully get us closer to the way people want to consume information and learn about, you know, what it is developers do and the product they deliver.
In that same vein, are there markets or other markets or other cities that you look to for inspiration?
Or other industries, actually, too.
There's definitely other industries, but there's a cross-section of different platforms that different industries use for their sales processes, for their information sharing, that we're trying to follow. We're trying to understand how something as substantive as a real estate purchase can fit its way into simpler methods of communication, simpler methods of digestion that I think other industries have done pretty well. I mean, that, you know, to get super trendy on it, you know, in this conversation would be like saying Tesla has reinvented the car buying process quite a lot. And
right.
And that was, I think, where like that was an industry previously full of sacred cows. It was like, there's only one way to do this. And pretty much everybody was doing a variation on a theme in my view. And, you know, these guys disrupted things, so many different elements. And in fact, we've interviewed folks who have had roles within Tesla for our organization. And it's fascinating where like one of the things that they adopted was really like just failing fast and recognizing those, you know, where what's not working in a process, what's not working in a customer facing or an intracompany kind of workflow that they're trying to establish, and they fix it. And they just try to, you know, ask the question, are we doing this because it makes sense, or are we doing it just because this is all we've been ever doing? Ask that question, think about whether there's a solution, try it on for size, and then pivot, you know, and then find, you don't need to be revolutionary, you just find avenues for progress that might be ultimately better for the customer. And that's an interesting pursuit. And that's why the competition thing for me is a funny one. I just feel like, yes, it's competitive-ish. I think everybody is super focused on delivering kind of the most relevant product to the market at the right time frame, making sure, you know, in the vein of being competitive, everybody is doing the same. I think that's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in other industries, competition kind of expresses itself differently. You actually have people trying to deviate quite significantly from the herd in order to differentiate their product or to get to the consumer a different way. And I feel like that's a link that just hasn't been squared off. And it would be fun, not just for ourselves, but I feel like it would be fun if there's some folks in this industry and then over the next generation that kind of reevaluate some of these norms and see if there's a way to you know, crack a different code.
And not to go too far off of the real estate kind of topic here, but I know you mentioned you have a Tesla. Just for people out there that are like, okay, how actually in terms of purchasing a Tesla, how is it different than, you know, most people think of, do I even want to go onto a car lot because, you know, pressure sales and some guy following up with me and all that type of thing. Presumably that's kind of the thing you're talking about, but can you just talk about how it actually...
It's really funny you say that because... No, I didn't walk in here and say I have a Tesla. It was
that was the first thing you said.
It was tertiary to another thing we were talking about. Let's just be clear. It was just like
people you actually drove in to the office. Yeah. To be like,
yeah. I heard some weird stories. No, so good fluke. I actually had a terrible experience with Tesla, which was actually what it made me fascinated in this whole thing. I bought my car right when they were like peaking with demand locally in like 2019, and they were just overwhelmed with delivery, and they hadn't sorted out the flow. And so it was actually through that. It was funny. There was so many things I was optimistic about through that process that ended up not coming to life very well. That was, I found fascinating. But the interesting part was the resilience for them to change their processes. And it was actually through interviewing some folks who work within that organization and following it over the last couple of years. You can actually see there's like fully acknowledgements of where mistakes were made and what they're going to do differently. And so it doesn't, you know, a group like that, they don't lose their resolve, even if there's a hiccup, to just keep pushing. Yeah, that's something that I think happens in this industry. You know, it's like, someone tried this. Oh, it didn't go over very well. Nobody's going to do it. Whereas it's like, well, yes, there was an attempt made at something different. It didn't hit the ground in the way folks were wanting it to be. And this could be marketing related. This could be product related, right? Someone tried a new building feature that fell flat for some reason, or it didn't resonate with the consumer or whatever. And it's like, it begs the question of like, well, is it worth, do you stop there and just say, well, we're never going to go down that path again? Or do you keep pursuing and find a way to kind of unlock that utility, but just with the focus to make it better?
Hmm. Yeah. And I always think, I guess the stakes are pretty high. And you think, in trying to understand why there is a resistance to that in the development community, is it reflected in the feedback loop maybe from the people purchasing the homes? Or is it just something that falls flat? And like, I'm just trying to understand, why do you think that is?
I think the feedback loop, I could be wrong, but from our experience and from the folks we've worked with over the years in different capacities, consultants and different partners on the sales side, I actually don't know how robust the customer feedback loop is. That's actually one of the issues. It's one of the innovation things. It's like, there's other industries doing really fascinating things when it comes to customer feedback. And I think that the way customer feedback is sought so far in industry is somewhat elementary. And it goes back to that point that because of population growth, because of the fact that there's a machine turning in terms of growth,
you don't need it.
That people haven't really sought to question that. And then I think development organizations like, so there's small development shops that have done really well. There's large ones that have done really well. Interestingly enough, I think, you know, in our observations is, they still generally lack robustness. You know, development companies can have, you know, they have the capital first and foremost to be able to play the game. You know, they build up hopefully talent within their organization to execute, and the talent is very difficult to find these days, but you know, that happens. And along the way, there's a big focus on project, and there's some focus on systems, there's some focus on kind of building a backbone to, you know, development companies. But I don't think it's as enduring as other industries. It's not like, because the process tends not to be too standardized. Developments, each and in their own right, are bespoke. They're all different. There's different approaches for every project for different reasons. It's all valid. But I think like the back end spine to like how things function and how do we get as much efficiency within the organizations themselves, I think because it at face value doesn't feel like it is that repetitive, that we're just scratching the surface when it comes to optimization versus industries where their products are way more homogenous. They can go deeper. So there's a sweet spot, I think, in development that, and again, because the product always sells, you know, if people are competent, of course, but if generally because the product ultimately moves, you can still succeed or fail, but ultimately developers don't end up having units that they can't sell at the end of the day. And so I think it's that full cycle of coming back around. It's the feedback loop. It's the, what do we need to do better? What needs to be optimized? You know, how do we take our practices that get for, you know, the approval process, construction process, sales and marketing, customer service, all these things. And like, there's been diminishing returns to invest a lot in trying to make those things better, because ultimately it's hard to see when you're only looking at the economics of the project outcome.
Right. Yeah. So in many ways, it's almost like innovation is a victim of market success.
I feel like it. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And it's not like, and this is all saying that generally this market builds fantastic quality product. Mm-hmm. We're actually, I believe we're delivering really good, as a standard in this industry, delivering really good quality to the customer. I think everybody should pat themselves on the back for that. That's as, and I say everybody, I mean all stakeholders. It comes from the city. I feel grateful we're in a region where there is a standard, kind of a minimum bar for urban design and placemaking and whatnot. You go to even places like, we're studying Toronto quite a lot. It's like, it's a different threshold. They're the same expectations. They don't uphold the same expectations through the chain. So from the beginning with the entitlements and the design process, there's definitely a dialogue, but it's more combative. And ultimately, I think there's lots of compromises in outcomes for city making. And I think here there's more integrity in that system, both within the planning community and in the interface with developers. That then evolves into obviously product and product design. We do things here. I think if you look at some of the product in other cities in North America, we've studied lots, it's like the average quality new home product that's delivered to in Metro Vancouver is at a completely different level than many other cities. And that's probably because it is a tight market. And maybe that is competition at play, mm-hmm. building quality. But I would say, like, you know, if you took a Toronto condo investor to average condo investor and moved or buyer, home buyer, you move them to Vancouver to look at a presale, they would think this stuff is fantastic. And conversely, someone who's a layman in the, you know, has no industry knowledge, just isn't in the interest of getting into a new home in Vancouver, going to Toronto, would see quality holes galore. Like, they would really at the consumer level, what the expectation is set here, I think people would go to other places and be disappointed with the results. There isn't as much integrity in the average, you know, product delivery. Mm. And so that's good. That's a good outcome. I think that's all, you know, it's all a good thing that this industry actually has set a relatively high bar for what the, you know, what average home should be looking like for folks.
Do you see that as an opportunity for other markets?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I see it as like a long runway ahead. This is the beginning of a new generation for our company. I say new, and not just in our family context, but like people, you know, we've been able to assemble a fantastic team. I feel so grateful for that. I think it's like, it's really foundational. Like you have to have people who want to buy into the same outcomes, support it, even especially when it comes to some of this, like lifting this, like if you're trying to innovate a bit, someone could look at that because with the industry norms at play, they could just look at that as noise from just doing the core job that they've learned working at two other companies they've been at, right? They just say, look, why do we need to do this? Or it doesn't really matter. They don't really care to double down on that piece. So you kind of first and foremost have to kind of like get to the headspace of a team that sees that, yes, we're going to continue to move things. We don't need to reinvent the wheel overnight. I would say like generationally, like think of it as like the upgrades you see on your phone. Like let's think of our product in a generational standpoint. Let's try to say, hey, we're doing this work in this band of 2-3 years. We're going to try to apply these standards. We're going to try to raise the bar to this level. Let's figure out our way to do that. And then let's look at the stuff that's beyond in the next cycle. And let's try to see where we go at the next stage and not try to fix everything at once or try to pretend like we have all these answers. Just be willing to like dig in. And you can't do that alone. You have to have people with the fortitude and interest to like dig, to drill into these things. So that's a huge part of the ability to look at some of this stuff.
Interesting. And so if I understand in terms of long runway, it's Metro Vancouver, but potentially other markets as well, kind of expanding.
So going back to that, we're looking at a number of other markets. And back to this long runway ideas, yeah, you have to have the team. And then with that, we feel like we're building capacity that will lend itself to distilling a strong backbone of how we do things. When I was going back to like processes and systems and operational kind of focus, it's like, build the backbone and then see where that gives you scalability, mm-hmm. and then where else could we go? And so for the last couple of years, we actually have a focus on this. We have resources in-house already that just focus solely on new markets. But we went with it with the long game in mind. We said, okay, look, we're going to start doing due diligence on markets in North America. You know, start with obvious ones that we thought there were interest for various factors. Start there and just study if there's a reason for us to compete. Like, why would you go? It's not like a big maniacal plan for us. We don't really care where things evolve over the years ahead in terms of scale. You know, we have to have rational outcomes, good business decisions, and actually want to enjoy doing what we're doing. If you don't have that, then, you know, might as well throw in the towel. So based on that, we're looking at all these markets saying, is there a reason to even go there? It's going to cause us, there's learning curves. There's all kinds of anguish and growing pains you go through. Is what we do here, what we're trying to like distill as a practice within our organization, all sides of it, is this going to give us kind of some new tools to take to a market and do something better than just compete with everybody else? Is there a part of the market where I don't know much about this in the Marcon side, often because it's not as widely known, but we've really spent a lot of time diversifying our work over the last 4 or 5 years. So we've got condo, rental, office, hotel, student housing, seniors, retail, like the whole spectrum of basically real asset classes. And we're not trying to do too much, but we're trying to drill in to really be sharp with opportunity. So when we go to these new markets, it's like, what's our reason to, you know, what is this market all about? Where could we be competitive? And so we kind of try to first look at it, the lenses of these asset classes, which our group is digging in on and saying, okay, Toronto's a great example. We've been studying that for a couple of years and was like, we don't see a reason to go try to buy tower sites in Toronto. There's lots of good sophisticated players there. And we're just going to be one of the mix if we try to go into that at this point. Maybe down the road, as things evolve, we have some competitive edge in a certain way, maybe, but like that didn't seem there. We've looked at other forms of development within that landscape, which we feel like there's a different reason to compete. And so that's where we're focusing our attention. So it's all for the long game to say that we don't have to jump tomorrow. We've been fortunate enough to commit resources to these investigations. Part of it actually gives you a lot of context for things you could take away and learn and bring back here.
Sure.
The other side of it is dig, figure out a really robust reason to do something, recognizing that there's an infrastructure you have to build if you want to do it right. And then we'll jump at some point into these spaces, I suspect, if it all works out, and put our best foot forward.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
We are also sponsored by Oakwin Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakwin, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakwin.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
Maybe changing gears a little bit and maybe moving on to some conversations around the market itself in Vancouver, maybe as kind of a launching point. Can we talk about the last 2 years just in the market and COVID and a crazy run that the market's gone on? Were you surprised by the past 2 years?
I think COVID in and of itself, the way I look at risk in the Metro Vancouver context is there's a stability in the growth story of this region. But all of that is notwithstanding any sort of like major global event that could change, you know, the course of the trajectory of the real estate industry here. I actually think global factors have a greater outcome than on people's comfort level in buying, their confidence in buying, than it is just the sheer reality that people continue to move here. So, you know, we did see a dip in just immigration through COVID a bit, of course, but our projections have changed and we're back onto normalizing and growing. I don't know, to me, I wasn't really that surprised that the recovery came quickly. I recall it was just before COVID started. So it was like January, February, 2019, 2020. The market was fairly soft before that. And that was coming off the backs of the, you know, some of the policy changes and interest rate fluctuations of 2017, 2018. We're getting to 2019. Everybody wanted to have that optimism that things were going to, it was really confidence again. It was like, not like people aren't moving here. It's just confidence in the market. We're feeling that. And then all of a sudden, you know, there were a couple big launches right at the beginning of 2020 where people were like, it's back.
It's back. Yeah.
And then of course, COVID came. That put things at a standstill for a period of time. But this is the momentum of this marketplace. This is the respect we've got to have for the fact that we're a growing region, is that at the end of the day, we have to meet that demand at some point. So, you know, with rates falling again significantly again, making, you know, accessibility into housing more attainable for folks, with the fact that we were already kind of deficit in supply in what the industry was building through 2017, 2018, mm-hmm. It kind of, I guess, you know, during that, it wasn't like we had a crystal ball in the moment, you know, of the peak of fear with COVID in the spring of 2020. But I really wasn't surprised as we got into the back end of 2020 and into 2021 that we were seeing that performance, because at the end of the day, they had to find a reason to see confidence in this market, because they can only waylay their lifestyle decisions for so long. Like investor or end user, these are people's lives we're talking about. They're waiting for the family formation. They're waiting, you know, or they're anticipating that, or they've been saving for an upsize. You know, I think people want new housing opportunities to evolve and change their lives, and they don't have freely stock available when there's population growth. So I think good time or bad time with all these global economic forces at play, I think at a point people realize they need to move on from that fear and move into, this is, you know, practically the life I need to make a life for myself. and I need to kind of get off my feet and make some choices in how I'm going to spend their means, right? So I can appreciate why the resiliency ended up being there. And, you know, it's a history that we've lived through in Vancouver. We saw the same thing in 2008. You know, it was not great for a period of time, but really not that long. And I think for similar reasons.
Interesting. Just thinking about the Metro Vancouver real estate market, I'm curious to kind of hear how Marcon, I guess, or your role as VP of development, how you look at the various submarkets and, and where you see the opportunities and you know, what a deal looks like, and how Marcon's approaching that.
Yeah, for sure. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say in the residential context because, clearly you guys are working in many different asset classes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's totally fair. What I will say though about the diversification is the insights on residential is that because we are in a relatively a small land constrained marketplace, and people have specialized often in being multifamily developers. From the history we look at, we've made this conscious choice where we see folks have grown, development companies have grown over the year, but they actually generally hit a critical mass. Like only so many doors get launched or built every year by one company. They just kind of like peak sometimes, but generally like there's a critical mass. And like what we feel we've observed is that actually what end up people happening is they amass capital and then they just buy more land to bank, but they're really only turning out so much into the market at any given time. And so we kind of took that and said, well, we love this region. We believe in the region for all kinds of different reasons from a real estate perspective, not just residential. And do we want to just keep building a deep residential condo pipeline? Or do we want to look at the region, the qualities in the submarkets and make choices about whether we just want to keep building a bank of land or do we want to operationalize more growth in different areas? And I think mixed use is a huge piece of this. Because for us, when we look at opportunities across the region, you know, transit orientation is huge from us. I'm sure there's been a dozen people on this podcast who've said the same. But it's true. I mean, it's just kind of fundamental to just sustainability and like just good practice for as a region to be focusing around that. So transit orientation or some other factor, and I'll say it's like it's got to be geographic. So it's got to be like some other kind of geographic reason that a place matters. You know, like people ultimately are pulled to places for all kinds of reasons. But part of it is it's like the qualities of the lived experience, right? So being beside transit is a huge, it changes a dimension for your life, right? And it gives you flexibility in all kinds of different ways economically and with your time. And similarly, the other choice is you pick a geography that its characteristics, its special factors also augment people's lives. They're making a choice to be in that community because there's something it affords, because you can hike in the mountains or kayak on the waterfront or whatever it is. And so we kind of weigh out both. You know, we've been in the White Rock area, you know, for years because for the right reason, for the qualities of that community, that we see that the growth that happens there making sense and we've done well there. At the same time, we have this general affinity for transit orientation. We've had a big presence in the Tri-Cities, Burnaby, Vancouver, and that'll continue. And for years, we've built a couple thousand homes on the North Shore, and we've developed several hundred. And I don't think people even really realize we've just chipped away at it over the years. Like that's another market where we just see there's the livable qualities within that market where, you know, we continue to keep our eye open just because we see that as enduring, and we see why from a lifestyle choice people want to be there.
It makes sense. If we're thinking kind of currently, do you have a sub region or an area that you're really excited about?
So we have lots of activity in Vancouver, but we tend to not, I'm going to say waste our time. It's maybe not a nice phrase, but we tend to not waste our time with trying to worry about being like the first in speculator who got a cheap deal on land on Cambie before Cambie was approved or Phase 3 was approved or Broadway's approved. It's like, I feel like people put themselves through like arbitrary stress, you know, totally. Sitting on the fence about what's totally. Going to happen. I'm like, you know, I'm going to bet that I can probably get a site with not much of a difference in cost at the right time when the dust is settled. And we've seen that evidence of that. We did, you know, Marpole plan. We did a whole bunch of Marpole and we didn't try to speculate on a bunch of stuff preemptive of the plan approval. West End, we did the same. Cambie Corridor Phase 3, we've done the same. In fact, I think people got bit on a lot of these areas where they were like overpaying for stuff, predicating kind of assumptions that make sense. So, you know, certainly, you know, one of the big lenses we look at is, I see the entitlement process is probably the riskiest part of our entire development process, because it tends to, there's outcomes from the approval process that can like transcend any sort of rational thinking. Sometimes it can transcend like risk mitigations that you're going to put in place. So you have to really be mindful of like, and it's not like we haven't taken risks through approval processes, but, you know, looking at municipalities where you know, both the timing of when you might make an investment in the municipality, where is it in its journey with a long-range planning kind of process in an area or whatnot, or whether it's the political climate, or whether sometimes it's literally just shifts in the bureaucracy. It's, you know, new leadership, whatnot. So we try to follow that to try to inform our choices, which is why, you know, this is a big end around to say, we don't put dots on the map and say, friends of mine in the industry, you know, sometimes they put dots on a map and say, we want to do this much in this market this year and this much in this market, and kind of get very, you know, literal about where they want to place bets in an ideal world. And we don't take that approach.
And just for listeners, when you say entitlements and the process, can you talk about an example of like, not necessarily Marcon, but where somebody, you know, where things didn't work out the way people were expecting? Like what is an example of where risk mitigation didn't work?
Yeah. So there's been areas in Vancouver where inclusionary zoning has been, inclusionary zoning meaning social housing contributions as part of condo development or below market rental as part of rental development. There's been areas where folks have made bets assuming that the policies are going to fall in a certain direction, and then things change. So one of, you know, a good example was West End. In the planning process, there was a commitment for delivering a certain amount of social housing in many of the condo developments in the West End. Some areas were explicitly zoned. They were actually, as part of the West End plan process, sites were actually rezoned through that process, which was really good because it took the rezoning piece of the equation. On other sites, they didn't, and I'm not actually sure why, because the context was really similar from a built form perspective. But, you know, the policy was generally the same. And going through the process, the West End plan process, the dialogue was pretty transparent about what they were trying to achieve. But then at the end of that process, when the policy was written for these areas, the city added an element to the plan which said, your contribution is 20% of your density on your site being social housing. And we're also going to evaluate that contribution versus the land market and see if there isn't still a land lift that we should extract. And then you would also owe us a cash payment. So there were folks who were going to go in buying sites, assuming the policy was a certain way, and then kicking and screaming later saying, but why am I writing you a check? Like, I'm giving you this contribution. This is crazy, whatever. And I was like, well, there's arguments to say there was some craziness in the, you know, thought process around why that was necessary, like from as an extraction. But at the same time, it was explicit. It wasn't like they hid it, you know, in the policy. It was there. Mm-hmm. And so that's the nuances piece. It's like, you know, what point do you want to jump in, and how much of a change in your outcome could a site have as a result of policy change? Canby Phase 3 was similar. There were some changes in the densities kind of prescribed in Canby Phase 3 as it evolved that affected some sites. And it goes on and on. Sometimes it's bonus density policy that's changing. So, you know, you're buying a site in one context with another, you know, with some policy context changing in the background that can kind of switch gears on things. So we'll watch that. It's like the plan might be approved, but if we know that there's a big shift in the way, you know, there's going to be, you know, taxation or, you know, fees and charges, et cetera, we'll watch that to say, well, maybe we shouldn't just assume that nothing is going to be that materially different from what exists today. Right. So it's sometimes explicit, sometimes it's not as explicit.
Right. It makes a lot of sense to wait for the dust to settle in many ways. And also, you know, to miss kind of the hype machine and wait till the market kind of is proven. Mm-hmm. And then if the numbers make sense, the numbers make sense.
And I think, you know, we've had our successes with the right, you know, buying things at the right time, for sure. But I don't know. I feel like life's too short sometimes to try to like go through the anguish of speculation. I just don't see it. I feel like there's other areas we can add value. We can, you know, earn our share to this process and get good outcomes for everybody.
And I feel like that's like obviously on a much smaller scale, but a lot of the kind of mom and pop investors listening to this show, and I don't think we talk about it as much, but if you kind of follow along, it's like buy right in this way that it creates this kind of stressful, you know, deal of the century type scenario where if you're not getting an amazing deal, then you don't buy. And it's like, you know, either you never buy or you put yourself through this.
It becomes a lot of fence sitting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And especially in a city like Vancouver where it's like,
it also suggests a very short runway on anything, right? You have to buy now. And because if you don't, you're going to miss the opportunity. But as we all know in real estate, and especially in these areas that are starting, it's boring to watch an area evolve, right?
Yeah.
And it should be, you know?
No, I hear you. Yeah. No, I totally follow that.
You know, just thinking about that kind of, you know, changes in politics, bureaucracy, policy, you know, all these things that you're kind of dealing with. And I feel like, you know, we have Tom Davidoff on all the time, who talks about kind of the lack of transparency with community and many contributions and how it's, you know, there's ways to make it more transparent.
I did not do well in his course.
I feel like certain people agree with him and others don't. We get feedback coming both ways when we have Tom on the show, but that's funny.
It's all good.
They'll bring you back for an honorary PhD, I'm sure.
Yeah, right.
but I'm wondering your thoughts on kind of how politics and public sentiment, which is I guess ever-changing, but always fairly negative, it seems, towards real estate and the development community. But how do politics and public sentiment factor into how you perceive building better cities or building Vancouver as a better city than it is currently?
Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, I guess this is actually another area where it's similar to like the life's too short thing I was saying about speculating on land. You know, we've certainly... you know, been involved in, you know, political, you know, trying to build relationships in the political realm, trying to look at the outcomes of political change that could make places be more supportive of development or not. But we try not to go too deep on that. You know, we're not a group that takes strong positions on topics and tries to kind of like try to cast any influence on the outcome. Because I think, you know, there's a bigger, I guess this is what I fall back on is like the region is growing. And I think, you know, over periods of time, there's some communities that may be reticent to have see change in their community, but I think that that can ebb and flow. And so, yeah, we try not to get too reactive on that front. It is a big factor, but I think at the end of the day, I think like many, my view just of politics in general, I think there's many sides of politics where you can get really caught up in the personas and the overt kind of messaging and the speculating on what could happen that kind of misses the fact that often it's still a lot of the same too. Mm. And I think we kind of like, you know, I think it's easy to get into the trap of casting a lot of kind of bets on risk as it relates to, you know, choices and in real estate investment on the political lens that we haven't found too necessary to be deep into. I mean, not like we ignore politics by any means. And we still, I love being welcomed into conversations with politicians because they ultimately are shaping places. But I actually care more about that element. Like, What are the outcomes that are lifting a community to a better place, and kind of ancillary to that, development finds its way into the mix most of the time. And, you know, I think that dialogue is kind of more progressive about, like, you know, community goals, how the work we do fits within those community goals, and over time, you know, I find often this stuff kind of washes itself out, right? And it is a long game, right? Like, sometimes for 3 or 4 years, a place, because of the political climate, which is a function also of the public sentiment, might not be interested in much change, but that often comes and goes. So we kind of see that resiliency in the communities around Metro Vancouver. doesn't make it easy.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it easy to do work, but I think my experience is that it gets overly hyped in terms of the influence on the outcomes.
Yeah. I mean, kind of the forest for the trees, but it does seem like, some of the larger developers we've had on the show, just an observation is, and I think you kind of fit into this trend, is like cutting out the noise and playing a longer game.
And like a bedrock confidence, right? In the region.
Totally. Yeah. And our approach with, working through approvals and in the community planning process, like we really try to start the ground up, like I really feel like the people who make often some of the most change in the outcomes of projects and the communities are the file managers, the people who are kind of responsible for shepherding your application through the process or responsible for championing the plan and getting the community engagement. Like we try to put our focus on, building good relationships with those folks and hearing them out and trying to like match our desires with theirs and thereby the communities at the same time. And if we don't have to call a director of planning or a mayor or whatever, I mean, I think they're probably happy for it too. Like the whole system is supposed to work. Let's remember, it's supposed to be equitable. It's supposed to have checks and balances. And we hang our hat on that framework first and foremost. And I think that's actually been part of the recipe for our success in the last number of years.
This will make the next question about interest rates sound kind of...
Well, I was actually maybe just to kind of in keeping in that vein. In a perfect world, Nick, what does Vancouver look like in, say, 2035?
2035, so that's...
Not to be too specific, 12 but in years. The next two decades, in your mind.
Mm. I think what happens is the biggest outcome we'll see in the 10 to 12 year range is the maturity of some of the large urban centers and the projects that are currently in planning take shape. And the scale will be unlike anything anyone's seen before in the region, pretty much. And I think there's a next generation of product generally that is a totally different league of complexity, of design quality, urban design outcomes, just livability, like the stuff that we're observing in terms of like the future of mixed use communities, I think is going to a totally different level. And I think we've seen that in the region. You've seen kind of mixed use nodes of early 2000s, late 90s. Their scale, their approach evolved again through like the kind of mid-aughts with, the Brentwood areas evolving, et cetera. In Metrotown a bit, Metrotown a lot, but there's more to come in some of these communities too. There's interesting stuff happening in Vancouver, of course, around Oak Ridge and what's happening there. But Oak Ridge and then a number of projects in planning right now, and some that are under construction in these major regional centers and from Surrey to Vancouver, are game changing. And I don't think I don't even know if through the process of selling the condos or doing the pre-leasing for rents or commercial, or whatever, I don't even know if people fully understand how different and immersive these communities are going to feel. And it's all for the better. Like it's really awesome. I think it's acknowledging some of these things, like families may find themselves in a multifamily living condition for the long run. And so these communities are more complete. They've got more amenities. There's better services. There's a spectrum of uses. I think people are getting wise to the hair shops and nail salons in a podium below a tower, that isn't even good for them. As now, sure, people need nail salons and hair studios, but only so many. And getting to the point that, it isn't equitable that, in Vancouver, you can walk out your door and get a bunch of services within, 10, 15 minutes of walk. Whereas you go out to some of these other urban destinations and they haven't yet filled out the full complement of kind of activities for all different, ages and types and abilities. And I think that's part of the next wave. I'm excited for that generation of kind of urban form to come to life, because it will bring a totally different, I think it will rip off the Band-Aid around the notion that, some of these other regional centers are going to be as important to the outcome of this place, this region in the long run, as Vancouver has. Like, it'll really start coming to life in 10, 15 years. these places will just be their own hubs for all kinds of different activity as a place to live and work and learn and whatnot. And we're just on that cusp now.
Oh, that's exciting. And is that, and I'm just thinking through kind of the that change you're talking about, is that like a product of, in your mind, density? Like that if you build it, they will come and the infrastructure will be there with the store where you can, you know, within 10, 15 minute walk, you'll have basically everything you need.
I think there's a couple factors at play, like density somewhat. I think, yes, generally the communities are higher density and more scale, but sometimes that's for some really interesting reasons. Like, municipalities have been looking for more tower separation. There's some things that like the kind of hierarchy of needs is evolving and, you know, in throughout the region where it's like, we're focusing on solar access. We're focusing on tower spacing and pedestrian comfort and wind and what good commercial looks like. There's a deeper knowledge for the average kind of planner and developer about what all these factors mean and what they have to do. And if they're wise, you take these factors, which you now have to consider and make them, you know, treat them as assets, not treat them as something that you're trying to avoid. And I think there's also for the larger developers also far less fear about what the commercial components represent in these mixed use communities. I think the general affinity of the past was, you know, build condos. I don't care about the commercial. So I'm going to try to minimize that as much as possible. And hopefully I can sell it and not lose money. And it was legitimately. I mean, there was times where it was just not carrying its weight. And there's all kinds of reasons to say COVID has had effects on the long-term prospect for that. But at the end of the day, community serving commercial is something that everybody still needs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's greater sophistication and confidence in that today going forward than there has been over the last 20 years.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting kind of that I'm trying to get a sense of how organically it happens, right? Because in some ways the old way of like minimize commercial, don't really think about it, you know, if we can get it off the books and not lose money, we're good, is kind of like, you know, presumably over time, organically, the kind of storefronts that the community needs would emerge, you'd think. But actually, it's not the case.
No, it's not. It is somewhat still the lemming factor where like somebody, you know, it was this incremental series of like somebody stuck their neck out there, gave the next person confidence that they could deliver that and they could make those commitments economically and to the city to deliver that and kind of incremental. So I think they've got all this kind of these incremental steps then leading to maybe it's generational. Maybe it's actually a mind shift in, you know, people who are casting influence over the development activities in planning and development community, where now it's more like purposeful. It's like people aren't just looking at the last project done in the area to influence what they should do next. They're going farther and wider and taking cues from other places in the world for precedence, acknowledging some of these things about kind of the less transitory nature of condominium living and more permanent community building. And I think that is tightening that.
Mm.
Innovation.
I have one more question. I know we've taken up a lot of your time here and we do have the five wire, which is quick questions, but I have one more kind of more just thinking about this conversation, right? Marcon obviously is active in across the region, different asset classes. This conversation has been so wide reaching or far reaching, I should say. And it seems like your grasp of kind of all these elements is so sophisticated. I'm wondering, like, what does an actual day in your life look like? Like, are you in meetings most of the day? Are you studying this? Are you meeting with people that are studying this? What does a day in the life of the VP of development at Marcon look like?
Well, there's two things I think about when you say that. One is I liken it to a treadmill. You know, if you've never been on the treadmill before, you're out of shape, you start and you're at speed one or two. And that's really hard and you work on it. And well, if you have the persistence, you work on that and you try the next speed and you struggle with it, but you get there and you get there. And so I kind of look at some of these parallels, and I say we, cause it's not just some of these topics today. I mean, this is stuff I've had again, the benefit of like really great people on our team who all want to like participate in this dialogue and this digging and this.
And they're all excited about.
Yeah. So like, it's not that, you know, this doesn't come out of just one person trying to think through all this stuff. It's cumulative, but it's like you get used to a different pace and you get used to doing the work and thinking forward and thinking kind of around. We're founded in quality. So here's the nuts and bolts. It's like, we're founded in quality. We don't just want to stand for be some sort of like tokenistic innovation, whatever company. No, we want to build good buildings. We want good processes and systems. We want to grow rationally, keep ourselves to a, you know, having a low ego organization with lots of contribution to the team. And if that fosters itself, the ability to innovate a bit and have some, and frankly, it's fun. I think it's like, it's actually what keeps you wanting to do it and like show up every day is you dig deeper. You try to go into these, you know, topics and think through them and what it means for your organization. So the treadmill thing is like, you just get a little bit better at doing all of these tasks and you can then start running a little faster. And, you know, 1 year to the next, you start feeling like you're at a different pace on the treadmill and our whole team, you know, comes along with it. And then the other thing is, someone told me this, ran into a person who worked in a role at Amazon. And he said that one of the kind of mantras within that organization was think big and dive deep. So in that organization, it's unacceptable to just be ethereal, and nor is it okay just to do the work. Their expectation at a certain level is that you have to do both. And I think that's a great parallel. What I really like is like, foundationally, we just want to do good work. Nobody's afraid of rolling up their sleeves and getting stuff done. It's not just a boardroom full of musings. And we actually like, yeah, you know, like I don't even take that many like, don't take a lot of time for like random networking. It's just like, you just, we're happy to do work because that's how you pay the bills. But at the same time, you kind of build that with a richness of thinking and create an environment where there's a lot of healthy dialogue and input and I guess curiosity and kind of inquisition. And so I like that idea. Think big, dive deep. And that's kind of, you know, that's something I think we try to emulate in our work.
That's a great, great answer. And thanks for explaining a treadmill to Matt, who's never been on one. Appreciate
you
that.
It looks like you've been on a treadmill.
maybe we'll wrap up with the 5-wire. Do you have time for that, Nick?
Sure.
The 5-wire is brought to you by Scalina Real Estate. Hey, that sounds familiar. Scalina Real Estate is a full-service real estate company serving Vancouver, offering comprehensive, tried and tested buyer and seller systems. With over a decade in the top 10% of realtors in the Lower Mainland and a perfect 5-star Google review, Scalina Real Estate can help with all your real estate needs. We also have an extensive network of the best industry professionals and trades right across the country. There's no reason to not get in touch. Head over to scalinarealestate.com to find out more. First question for you, Nick. One book you would recommend to all of our listeners?
Oh, come back to that at the, I'll go back to that at the end. I'll think while I'm trying to answer the other
ones. All right. Well, we'll move to this one then, Nick. In the last 5 years or so, what new belief, behavior, or habit has improved your life?
Getting to bed on time.
That's a good one.
Good sleep.
What have you binge watched lately, or your favorite movie?
Well, it's been a rainy winter and we have a 6-month-old at home. So there's been all kinds of watching of films. So I watched Coda the other day.
Oh, nice.
And that was seriously impressive film. That was one of those ones you kind of put in the memory bank as a good one. So,
wow. We've been meaning to watch that. So that's exciting.
It's very worthwhile. Yeah.
What have you, favorite band or music?
Well, I'm actually classically trained in piano. I grew up with a lot of music. So genre, I actually love classical music and jazz, but mainstream, I'm like, I don't know, Coldplay sucker or even more popular than that sometimes, but I'm pretty much all over the map. Yeah.
Interesting. Wow, classically trained. Jeez, Nick, you're a cosmopolitan man of wonder.
Renaissance man.
Renaissance, what comes to mind.
That's a stretch.
Something you have purchased for under $1,500 in the last little while that has changed your life.
$1,500. AirPods.
Nice. That's a great one. And then returning to the book, I think that's...
Returning to one book you'd recommend for our listeners.
Someone in our group gave me a book about the founder of Four Seasons. And I've been kind of chugging through that when I've had the time. I don't get to read long form very often, but I finally closed that book after picking pieces of it after a long time. And I thought, this Canadian guy, fascinating journey. And so, yeah, Isidore Sharp biography, it's autobiography. It's fascinating. It's a good story.
Sounds great. And now that you don't have the commute, you can't do Audible either. So I guess it's your consumption of media has probably dropped off.
It's a lot shorter.
Yeah.
And with the baby, it's also a lot shorter.
Right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Nick.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Fascinating conversation. And obviously, it's kind of a silly question for a company like Marcon, but how can people find out more about what you're doing over at Marcon?
We spend a lot of time on this. Marcon.ca. None of this live at the shore, at the north, at the whatever.ca. No, Marcon.ca. That's it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for your time.
Thanks a lot, guys.
There you have it, folks, our discussion with Nick Pallella, VP of Development over at Marcon. And I should say, Matt, we do have new equipment here today.
A live studio audience.
Yeah, exactly. This is like going to be like cheers. Like when there's like a joke, it's going to be, you'll be playing Norm. Here's the thing about our conversation with Nick. There's so many takeaways. I can't believe it, but an hour and 20 minutes flew by. Hopefully it did for you, the listener, as well, but it definitely did for us in studio.
No, there's no doubt it did for the listener. There was so many interesting, like I said, we left that conversation. I was truly thinking every answer, there was no pat answer. Every answer was kind of very, very thoughtful and really, like you said before, challenging the status quo on kind of all fronts. It was really, really a great conversation.
Well, we're going to have to convince Nick to come back and join us for another conversation because, that was fantastic. What else do we got for the day, though, Matt, before we cut?
Before we cut for the day, Adam, we have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live, including the Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast. So head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com where you can sign up for things like the LiveWire. This is our weekly mailer.
Right.
No obligation. There's VIP residential presale projects. There's VIP commercial presale projects. There's deal of the month. There's stats before anyone else has them. There's stats that no one else has. Basically, everything you want real estate related. But also, Adam, we have private client services.
Because Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free at your fingertips. It's available at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. It is the best way to look for real estate in Vancouver. I love it. I'm actually getting like, it's insane.
Well,
here's the thing.
Here's the thing. And this is, I promise you, this renovation project I mentioned at the start is not going to be just a long pitch for PCS. But no. PCS played a role.
PCS actually was an integral role
in finding that deal.
And we'll talk a little bit about how you can set up PCS to find a deal for yourself. So stay tuned for that, Matt. How can people get in touch?
They can get in touch with me at any time, 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We also got that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And I think it goes without saying, the episodes just keep on coming here.
Yeah.
I'm excited about the future. I'm excited about today's episode. These are... You know,
you're just excited.
I was happy with the show before, but I feel like we're going to the next level.
You're a career optimist. And here's the thing. Some of the episodes coming in the future are some, I'm not even going to spend time on teasers, but we've got some fantastic guests. Super excited. If you do enjoy the podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you're listening to this on Spotify. And also please share it with a friend. That's how we grow. And have a great week, guys. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.
2,000 Spaces for Radio.
Subscribe today.